are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 11th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the coming of the American behemoth, the origins of fascism in the United States from 1920 to 1940. May give us some clues about what's going on now. By Michael Joseph Roberto. Also on the program today, another shutdown looms as Democrats insist on capping the number of immigrant prison camps we can have in this country. Meanwhile, in Virginia, Lieutenant Governor Fairfax impeachment now being discussed as Northam digs in. And in Colorado, Denver teachers strike, and they're doing it for the first time in 25 years. Meanwhile, Amazon claims their fees are hurt and may go somewhere else.
Goodbye.
Guaido in Venezuela weighing whether to authorize the U.S. intervention. Must be nice.
Yeah, just spitballing.
Hey, maybe I'll authorize it.
Yeah, maybe. Hey, I am, you know, I did declare myself head of state, so obviously I could welcome a foreign intervention anytime I please.
Just an idea.
An idea.
Crowdsourcing just ideas.
Just crowdsourcing endogenous ideas.
Klobuchar enters the race amid reports of her abusive behavior to staffers.
But Republicans love her. So Republicans love her and staffers flee from her. Klobuchar 2020.
Ilhan Omar attacked for criticism of Israel. And Steve Schmidt, a little touchy about selling his soul.
A little sensitive.
Meanwhile, the estate tax touches no family farmers, as we know. However, Trump's trade war has pushed twice as many family farms into bankruptcy in 2018. And lastly, Arizona license plates secretly fund anti-LGBTQ groups. That's nice. All that and more. On today's program, not all of those license plates, just, of course, the ones that say, "In God We Trust." We'll talk about that later. But why wouldn't they? If you that's just the price you pay for religion, folks. That's just the price you pay.
Gotta have God.
Gotta have a lot of God. We will get to the shutdown. I mean, on some level, you know, there's not a lot more that we can say about this situation other than that's where it stands now. I imagine Republicans are very concerned about this. And I hope that labor unions of folks who work in the U.S. government, or I should say are impacted in any way by the U.S. government shutdown. So that includes, you know, the flight attendants who don't work for the government but rely on federal air traffic controllers and TSA folks to keep them safe when they fly. Remember, I mean, if you're flying as much as they do, you don't want there to be any even minor, never mind appreciable, reduction in the amount of flight safety. And so hopefully, in the event that there is a shutdown, and we will know, obviously, by Friday, end of day Friday, these folks are not going to wait around a month. They're just going to say, "We're done with this. We know where this goes. We're there." So we shall see. Meanwhile, You know, don't like to usually talk about the behind the scenes at other podcasts because, I mean, who cares? Although this is an interesting story. As you know, we've been talking about Steve Schmidt a little bit lately because he and his brother-in-arms, Bill Burton, both, what's the name of that god with the money? What's the, Schwartz. Mammoth? No. Who is it? Who do you sit to, you know, you bow
Lakshmi.
Down to? No, I don't know.
I don't know. Are you thinking Hindu god? What,
I can't remember.
Moloch?
Yeah, maybe Moloch. No, not Moloch. Is that the money? Anyways, these guys...
Steve Schmidt's like sitting here like, these guys don't know the money god.
Don't
losers.
Know the money god. I mean, look, I like money.
Mammon.
Mammon. Yeah, there
mammon.
You go. Mammon. Oh. I like money. Money's good. That's great. But I think it would take a tremendous amount of money for me to not just sell out, but to sell out so nakedly and so vividly. Right. Like, it's one thing to say, like, yeah, 15 years ago, I believed that, but today I don't. So I'm going to take a chunk of change. It's much tougher to do that when it's like 6 weeks ago, I believed something wholeheartedly. And then all of a sudden somebody drove a Brinks trucks up to my house. And I was like, who's going to notice? Well, apparently a lot of people noticed when Steve Schmidt did it. And I don't know how much money Howard Schultz is paying Steve Schmidt. But I imagine there are a lot of zeros at the end of that figure, and that the figure itself may very well be double digits. Maybe it's just a single digit, but I have a feeling that there's at least six zeros after it. Right. And apparently he just thought, nobody's going to notice. Certainly not the people who work on the podcast I do every week are going to notice. And, so Steve Schmidt has this podcast called Words Matter, which, of course, is a little ironic because
that's a Trump dig, right?
Yeah. He said a lot of words, though, about
words
how
matter.
In fact, there was a piece in Vanity Fair, I think when they were launching this podcast, and he does it with Elise Jordan, who is, you know, sort of a I think she's now a former Republican, and always had sort of, sort of moderate leanings. She's nice. I've met her multiple times. We did a panel with her at Politicon, but also at MSNBC for years. She was married to a journalist who, you know, people may remember, who wrote for Rolling Stone, who ended up dying in a car accident.
Oh.
And
what was his name? I'm totally forgetting his name. He was a really good journalist.
Anyways, I just want to read this before I forget. Back, I guess this was in August, they launched this podcast, Words Matter, as an answer to Pod Save America, which is like, what could be more Pod Save America than Pod Save America? And they said, Words Matter. No, I made that part up. And at the time, Schmidt told Vanity Fair that he thought the conservative movement, and by extension, the Republican Party, which he had left 2 months earlier, had become a racket. In other words, people were just taking these political positions for money. Right? I mean, that's what we mean when we say a racket. Right? It's just a way in which you can make money. It's not legit. It's disingenuous. It's just done for the money. And then, now granted, this was all the way back in August of last year. So that's someone do the math. That's almost 8 months ago, maybe a little bit less.
It's a long time.
But it was 2018. So it's you could also argue it's a different year.
Before the midterms.
And it was before the midterms, which seems like a year ago. And time is dilated. So in many respects, you know, during the Trump era, a human year feels like a dog year in some respects. So he may have forgotten that he was launching his new career based upon, like, we're not about, pulling some type of racket. We're not going to just, we're not up here just doing this for the money. America is important. And then somebody comes around, a billionaire, and offers them God knows how much cash. But I suspect if it was like in $100 bills, you would not be able to carry it. If it was in $100 denomination.
Steve Schmidt wouldn't be able to carry it.
I don't think anybody. I think you need a truck. I think you would need at least a pickup truck. And I'm talking like an 8-foot bed.
Turns out words aren't the only thing that matter.
Yes. Words, parens, and other things sometimes too matter. But so his podcast is EP'd by a guy who is sort of a long-time Democratic operative, but you know, sort of like probably like a moderate Democratic operative. And I think he was the one who set up the podcast. And this guy, Adam Levine. And so Elise Jordan, Adam Levine, sat down last Tuesday with Steve Schmidt to interview him about Schultz. And apparently there was a lot of screaming and yelling, according to this Newsweek article. Or Daily Beast article, before they sat down. Finally, he agreed to sit down and talk about the Schultz thing. But seems like something was eating at him a little bit. And, well, he snaps.
Will this be, if Howard Schultz does decide to enter the race, will he run an issues-driven campaign? And will reducing the deficit continue to be, as he said, his primary focus?
I think the thing that you will most see from him in the conversation that lies ahead is honesty. He's going to have a very honest conversation, a very adult conversation with the American people about all manner of issues that have not been talked about seriously in a long, long, long time. I mean, we have a debate that rages in this country, if you look at all of the issues facing it, that is about a wall on the southern border that is completely unnecessary in a moment of time where there's zero net illegal immigration coming across the southern border.
Steve, you say he wants to have an adult.
All right, pause it for 1 second. Before we get to, just wanted to contemplate the idea, like what topics are Howard Schultz going to talk about? Like I know what Donald Trump is talking about. What topics of Howard Schultz are going to talk about that are not covered by somebody running for office in the Democratic Party, right? Like we have a full range of voices in the Democratic Party. We're going to see more, right? We haven't even begun to see. I think we're at the halfway mark in terms of the number of candidates we're going to see. And they're going to range from, you know, Joe Biden and maybe Bennett on one end of the Democratic Party. We're going to be talking about deficits, maybe. I'm going to be talking about, like, you know, we don't want to go crazy with some of this crazy policies.
Careful with the deficit.
But we should attack different nations.
And then people like us saying that we want a childish conversation on Medicare for all.
Then you get the childish, you know, of course, the childish end who are like, maybe we should just provide benefits to the American public that they're really excited about and would help their daily lives. So all of that's going to be in there. I don't know what Schultz is talking about. It's almost as if like the words he's saying are not true, that they're like just spin. But then his co-host or his executive producer is not his host. But is for today, says, well, let's talk about childish.
Steve, you say he wants to have an adult conversation. Last week, he called a 70% tax on incomes over $10 million ridiculous from a United States congresswoman who happened to have been elected to something. Now, I know you're a guy of words, Steve, and ridiculous means deserving or inviting derision or mockery, absurd. Synonyms, comical, hilarious, we could go on, farcical. Does he really mean that a tax on incomes over $10 million at 70%, which is widely popular with the American people, is ridiculous? Is that an adult conversation?
Yeah, I think he thinks it's ridiculous and it's confiscatory and that it's anti-growth. That would be his point.
Will Derek Jeter or another athlete not hit another home run because they're going to get taxed at 70? What's the economic behavior that he thinks it's anti-growth other than his own pocket?
Adam, this is bullshit. I'm not doing this.
Steve, you got to answer the questions.
I'm not.
You got it, Steve.
I'm not.
Unfortunately, the interview ended there. We wanted to ask Steve some serious and important questions about his new role.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Steve. We hate you back.
Well, Steve basically just screwed them over too. Ended the podcast more or less, I guess. Blew it up because he has to go work for Schultz, and you know that's a full time job when you are pretending to. I mean,
he took a confiscatory approach to that podcast earnings.
Exactly. He's also a confiscatory approach in terms of some money he's going to take from Steve from Howard Schultz.
Oh yeah, he's got a very confiscatory approach to Howard Schultz's money.
Now let me just say this. I will say this. Okay, in all fairness, Steve Schmidt, he has shown that he has got more comfortable, that there is something, I want to say there's something inherently with being a Republican that makes you run a racket, right? Because as much as he sort of left the Republican Party because it turned into a racket in the conservative movement, because it turned into a racket, he ended up falling back into another one. Very shortly after that, which incidentally threatens the very thing that he left the Republican Party for, which is to reelect Donald Trump.
And may I also just state, this guy gave us Sarah Palin.
And I was going to say,
apologize.
I remind you, this is the guy who basically, I don't know if he was the midwife for Donald Trump. He was like the doula for Donald Trump. He just helped in the birthing of Donald Trump by bringing us Sarah Palin. But to be fair, as bad as Steve Schmidt is, Bill Burton may be worse. Because Bill Burton, you know, supposedly, not only supposedly came from a better pedigree in terms of his politics, right? But he got his old firm to try and tell Democrats to lay off Starbucks because Starbucks was taking grief because of Howard Schultz.
I think we're going to need to really think about this, guys.
Guys.
Because I've got an opportunity to make a stupid amount of money.
Yeah, listen. So that doesn't trump everything, but it should trump most things. And so can we just lay off Starbucks, please?
I think we're going to need to risk having a bigger imagination about the Starbucks brand.
Sort of feel like you guys are inhibiting your risking of a brave new imagination about the things I could buy.
But Bill Burton would have been better on that pod, though. He would have sat there and he would have been like, oh, I'm really glad you asked that.
Right.
That's total nonsense.
Right. That's a great question.
Oh, that's an awesome question. Wish we could go longer.
Now, what's going to be interesting is how Howard Schultz reacts to this. Because if it was Donald Trump would be very pleased with Steve Schmidt. You told those guys off. You said F you to them. It's going to be interesting to see if Howard Schultz doesn't distance himself from Steve Schmidt now, or if he likes that, a la Donald Trump. So I guess that's the question. Howard Schultz, are you Donald Trump? Are you Howard Schultz? Or really, is there a difference?
Decaf Donald Trump.
It's probably the difference between 4% and 5%.
Yeah, that's right.
Decaf Donald.
I'm a real billionaire, says Schultz.
I mean actual money.
All right.
He did with a certain degree of class.
Oh, I already told you guys what happened last time we got a shipment of Sherry's Berries in here. We had a lot of the crew who had traveled to see the Michael Brooks show was here, and thank God. I think Jeff from Georgia had about four of those things. But, I mean, I begged him to because I can't have, I mean, I can have one, but if there's more of them than that, I'll eat all of them. They were delicious. Huge strawberries dipped in, they had milk, dark chocolate, white chocolate. They're beautiful. Any discerning palate will love these. They're topped with a decadent chocolate chips and heart and glitter sprinkles. I'm having trouble reading this now. Your Valentine will fall in love with every bite. These are the perfect companion to a candlelit dinner, a bouquet of flowers, or a night on the town, and they ship anywhere nationally. They always arrive fresh with 100% Sherry Berries guarantee. Valentine's Day is just days away, so send your Valentine the gift of their dreams at the price of your dreams, just starting at $19.99 plus shipping and handling. Order now. Make this Valentine's Day really special by adding a dozen red doses, roses for just $19.99. More. Jamie took those home and said they were beautiful. They're shipped with your Sherry's Berries at no extra charge. Just go to berries.com. Click on the microphone, enter my code CEDAR at checkout. So that's berries.com, berries.com. Click the microphone, enter the code CEDAR, order today. And, this is a big problem in this country. Every 2 seconds, there's a new victim of identity theft. Which means a criminal could be spending your money, applying for loans in your name, even damaging your credit. Unfortunately, you can miss certain threats to your identity just by checking bank statements and monitoring your credit. There's all sorts of, look, every day it seems like we're hearing about another massive data leak. Good thing there's LifeLock Identity Theft Protection. LifeLock uses proprietary technology to detect and alert you to a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web, for instance. And if you do have an issue involving identity theft, one of LifeLock's identity restoration specialists will work to help you fix it. This is the hardest part about all this. I've heard nightmare stories of it, of people
it back.
Taking years to deal with this stuff. It screws up your ability to get a car loan. It screws up your ability to get a student loan. It screws up your ability to get a mortgage. It screws up your ability to get other credit cards, or when they check you out, maybe even to rent a car. Of course, no one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But with LifeLock, you get identity theft protection and additional features to help protect your devices against cyber threats for as low as $9.99 a month, I should say. Don't waste another second. Visit LifeLock.com/majority now to save 10% on your first year. That's LifeLock.com/majority for 10% off. LifeLock.com/majority. Check it out. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Professor Michael Joseph Roberto from the University of North Carolina, North Carolina and T State University, on his book, The Coming of the American Behemoth, The Origins of Fascism in the United States, 1920-1940. Right back.
When the moon
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Michael Joseph Roberto, a retired faculty member of the North Carolina Agricultural Technical State University, where he taught contemporary world history, longtime political activist in Greensboro, North Carolina, and the author of The Coming of the American Behemoth, The Origins of Fascism in the United States, 1920 to 1940. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, for having me.
Let's start with your definition of fascism so that we can, you know, make sure that everyone's terms are at least aligned in the, in this context.
Okay. My definition of fascism, first of all, comes from how others defined it, specifically the people who make up the pages of my book, their writings. And they define fascism more or less in a way in which there was a consensus and a discourse that fascism in America represented the power of big business, that fascism was, in fact, big business in power, business as a system of power. In its essence, finance, capital itself was fascist. Fascism was defined as the rule of finance, capital. And that's pretty much my definition, because many of them were Marxists, and so am I, to the extent that we all followed a basic method in determining who had power, who lacked power, and what the contradictions were, and how fascism came to being in embryonic form in the U.S. in the 1920s, in the 1930s. So my definition of fascism is not an original definition. I see myself in the long line of Marxist analysis, and also people who are inspired by Marxist analysis, but were not themselves socialists. And my book has many examples of individuals like that. So I hope I've answered your question that way. I mean, to this extent, fascism as a function of capitalism is not right now paramount in the discussions that we are having about fascism in the present. And I think that what my book points to is the necessity for having this kind of discussion so we can broaden out what we mean by fascism in the present. And fascism in the present is what it was in the 30s, even more so. And so my book is about the coming of the American behemoth, and now the behemoth is at full strength.
So, okay, so just, I mean, help me, let's just go a little further in terms of, you mean, you say the business system and the rule of finance capital. I mean, how does this, in the context of the 20s, and then I think maybe people can start to see those, see it a little bit clearer today in relationship, but how does that in the 20s manifest itself in a day-to-day, month-to-month basis?
In America. Okay. Well, I guess one way to do that, since the 1920s is a starting point, is to just briefly begin to answer your question by contrasting life in America in the early 20s and life in Italy in the early 20s, specifically in 1922 when Mussolini came to power. And many, many people, many Americans, have an understanding of fascism first appearing in history in Italy in the 1920s, and then, of course, a decade later with Hitler. Now, going back to the U.S., the U.S. is the epicenter of the capitalist world system after World War One. It is the world's leading creditor nation. It has surpassed Great Britain as the world power, but in a way in which its power is unprecedented as a capitalist empire. The 1920s in the United States is known as a period of great prosperity, the prosperous 20s, the great boom. It's in the 1920s when American capitalism in its monopoly finance form takes greater and greater control over American life, over American society, over its political institutions, and over the life of the individual itself. And it does this primarily in two ways, in two fundamental ways. If we define fascism as the rule of finance capital, and that means that fascism is inherent in American capitalism, then two fundamental processes, two main categories of processes come out of this. One is what we call terrorist processes, and the other are non-terrorist processes. Both seek the same thing, the domination of capital over society. During the Great Boom, when American capitalism is reached unprecedented power, not only in terms of its national economy, but because of its global outreach, it is an empire in the process of becoming one. Life in America is suddenly transformed into a giant boomtown in which production of different kinds of goods is unprecedented. And in this boom, we find the greater and greater power of monopoly, of capitalist enterprise. And it is based on being able to, first of all, pacify labor in 1919 and 1920, where the challenge, the great challenge of labor to the capitalists is put down. And then the boom begins in 22 and lasts until 29. This boom is based on the need to constantly produce, and it is an explosion of production that is directed toward consumer goods, and of course the capital goods, goods that are used to make consumer goods itself. So we get this tremendous burst of production and prosperity, and it has to be sustained on the basis of capitalist production and the laws of capitalist accumulation, which I argue in my book and which comes from Marx. This means that at home in the 1920s, the seeds of fascism come at a time of prosperity when there is growing all kinds of products available, which some people are able to buy, and then more people are able to buy because they borrow to buy it, and so we get installment credit. And here's where the whole non-terrorist aspect of fascism comes into play in a moment of prosperity. You must keep people consuming in order to keep producing, and this relies increasingly on an American population that is promised uninterrupted prosperity. And in 1929, finds out that the process, we discover that the so-called prosperity was actually only prosperity for a few, and very little changed in terms of material progress for the vast majority of people in this country. So that's the long answer on the 20s. In other words, fascism, we usually think of fascism as terrorism. Well, fascism is terrorism, but it's also, as a function of capital, it's also based on acquisitiveness and the ability to sell and the ability to convince people to keep buying into the system, where the marketplace becomes a more democratic place, as many Americans are taught to believe, than the polling place. And these are all fascist processes because they extend the role, they extend the power of capital over all of us.
Okay, so the idea being, if I understand you correctly, because I'm trying to sort of, I think like when people contemplate the idea of fascism, it involves a one-party dictatorship, right? And it doesn't necessarily right. have to be, obviously, right. a political party per se.
Right.
It right. is fundamentally anti-democratic. It is, in some respect, totalitarian. It is involves sort of like a rigid set of or a, you know, a rigid set of rules in which one can, you know, function without getting in trouble, essentially, in the context of society. And so your argument is that finance capital essentially, because they were so dominant in this era, that they were imposing both what you call a terroristic and a non-terroristic fascistic rule in that sense. And
yes.
The non-terroristic yes, is almost like a soft is the function. And I'm just trying to, you know, sort of, you know, bring folks into, you know, understanding these terms. The non-terroristic is sort of like a soft terrorism, like where, look, you know, you have to where you start buying into the notion of being coerced on some level, I guess, right?
Yes.
By material needs and whatnot,
yes.
and the more terroristic is, hey, you don't pay your bills, we're taking your house, essentially.
Yes. Yes, that's how the legal arm, that's how legality, or in a state that becomes more and more gangster-like because it departs from constitutional principles, I mean, what you have are legalized illegalities. That's a form of coercion, and I guess it's a form of terror when it comes to the terror that one can inflict on the mind. But let me try to paint this kind of portrait here with respect to our understanding of what we commonly think of as fascism, as the opposite of democracy, as dictatorship, where in the case of Italy and Germany, fascism comes to power as a result of a mass movement. Less so in Italy, because even though it's the first regime, a fascist regime that comes to power, it in many ways is the first and therefore an experimental kind of model. In other words, it has all of the characteristics that make for what we understand to be fascism. But we should try to recognize it as a European manifestation of fascism, in which the driving force was a movement from below. In the case of Mussolini and the fascist people who built a movement very, very quickly, or one big enough to basically convince the various parts of the ruling class in Italy that they were the only bet against socialist revolution. And so what you get out of that is then the rise of a corporate state where there's this phony existence between capital and labor. But of course, the whole thing is held together by Mussolini and his ability to basically always promise the capitalists that they're going to get whatever they want. My point here is that what you get is a dictatorial regime in Italy. And then, of course, you get something even more intense in the same way in Germany, where the forces at work are much greater in magnitude. And the end result is a dictatorship that is unprecedented in world history, from which we get the Holocaust. We get genocide and Holocaust and World War. In the U.S., in the 1920s, again, if we understand that these folks in the 30s and the early 40s who were writing about fascism were really onto something, and we then look at fascism as a world historical phenomenon that is unique to the 20th century and now into the 21st century, then what we see in the U.S. is the actual genesis of fascism as the aim of capitalist dictatorship, which is a reflection of the dictatorship of capital. So in the U.S., during the period of prosperities, during the period of the boom, you get this tightening of capital's control over American society, where labor is more and more chained to capital, and people's fate in so many ways is connected to capitalist enterprise. And while all this is going on sort of peacefully in the U.S. in the 20s, it's U.S. capitalism that is also primarily behind fascist Italy. From the mid-1920s right up until into the early 30s, until Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. So my point is here if we understand fascism from the standpoint of terrorist and non-terrorist processes, we see all of this developing within the framework of the U.S. empire in the 1920s. And then, as a result of the contradictions within capitalism, which is something we have not talked about here, then the crisis then creates an intensification of both terrorist and non-terrorist forms during the period in the U.S. during the 1930s. I mean, in my book, at the end of chapter 7, you will read about how in the desperation of Hoover's inability to end the Depression, you got people calling for a Mussolini in this country. What America needs is a Mussolini. When Roosevelt first came into office, he was urged to suspend the Constitution and create a Council of State that would temporarily manage the U.S. And pull it out of the crisis, out of the Depression. So these are all very complex historical questions that my book just begins to introduce to the public. I mean, all I'm trying to do here is bring to our attention this earlier discourse on fascism that was buried by later historians. And the reason why it was buried by later historians is because it demonstrated the absolute connection between fascism and capitalism.
Okay,
and liberal historiography has buried that for decades.
And I attempted to anyway. Yeah, and I want to talk about to what extent, and I think I don't want to jump ahead here, but I imagine for the most part we've been dealing with that non-terroristic fascism that capitalism has exerted for much of the remaining 20th century after the post-World War era. But before we get there, let me how was it that, and I think I know the answer to this, but I think it's worth exploring. How was it that capital created a greater, and particularly finance capital, created a greater, reliance of the people on finance capital as we entered into the 20s, as opposed to, say, the turn of the century or, the late 1900s?
Well, I'm not an economist, but I would have to say that the reason for finance capital having the control that it has to do with the stages of capitalist development. Once we enter the monopoly stage, and through competition, the monopolies get fewer and bigger in number, they require more and more credit. And so to the extent that I understand what Marx is saying about in chapter 25 of volume 1 of Capital, the necessity for credit becomes necessary for further capitalist accumulation once the monopoly stage is achieved. And again, in the U.S., if the U.S. is the strongest capitalist power, the epicenter of the world system after World War I, and then it becomes an even greater power after World War II, then that means that finance becomes supreme because the whole system runs on the basis of finance. So if I understand your question, correctly, that's the answer that I would give. And this is how, despite the failings or whatever, the Occupy movement in 2011 looked at the source of the problem. The source of all power, of all inequality in America. And despite the problem of the 99%, we know how important it is to see the divisions within the 99% and to see how capitalist oppression and brutality operates on the basis of race and gender and promotes greater inequality. So we see these differentiations, but the power of finance capital has never been greater. And I think the laws that govern the movement of capital in the period of late capitalism, which corresponds to the period of contemporary world history, in other words, a period of 1880s, from the 1880s to the present, the period that Lenin himself said it defines modern imperialism. Imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism. We are living out what I think is the end game of capitalism, which is the complete power of finance over all of us, and the extent to which it creates spectacles for us to continue to buy into, of which none of us are immune. I mean, very few of us can say that we're immune from the spectacle and the magical spell of capital over our lives. This is in its essence fascism, because it seeks and has succeeded in taking control of the government. And so what we get now is a ruling class that I think wants more and more of whatever it can get from most of us, while it seeks to get more of what it desires or it thinks it needs or it must have, and that is Venezuelan oil. So I think we're looking at a very, very dangerous moment. And this, to me, as somebody who's written a book about the origins of American fascism, this is pointing more and more, for me, toward fascism as the end game of monopoly finance capitalism.
Okay, and before we get to that end game, let's go back to the 30s and just follow that transition, because this is the era in which it's born, and much of it's sort of the relationship that fascism as a result, or I guess as a phenomena of finance capital rule, is right. Sort of that dynamic is created, I guess, in the 30s, which... explain to us how that is the case, you know, relative, let's say, the New Deal, right? I mean,
okay.
which presumably on its face seemed to be maybe diametrically opposed.
Well, the New Deal is a very, as you know, Sam, in my book, I have a chapter on the New Deal, and the chapter is called is entitled "The New Deal as a Transition to Fascism." It's a question:
right.
The New Deal as a transition to fascism, and this is a very, very difficult. A difficult view for us to wrap our heads around, because we identify the New Deal with a bold and successful plan to take America out of the Depression, led by a political party and an individual himself who promised the common man in America an end to the Depression and a return to prosperity. But not the prosperity of the 1920s that had actually led to the crisis and led to Hoover's presidency, which showed to the world that one part of the political machinery in this country, the Republican Party, was hands down a friend of big business, and it had always been a friend of big business, and so the so-called prosperity had led to a great bust and a great crisis, and then Hoover and his friends, Hoover and the Republicans, and the people who basically in big business still sided with them, turned their back on the suffering of the American people. Roosevelt promises a new deal, but Roosevelt is not going to go. He's not going down a socialist road. He's going to preserve capitalism. How do you preserve capitalism once it's reached its monopoly finance stage? Well, you save the monopolies and you save the banks. And of course, if you examine the New Deal, and I go over it again in my book, not in great detail because many, many fine historians have done that, but in essence, what the New Deal did was to stabilize the system by giving power in all of the agencies that it created, especially the National Recovery Agency, the National Recovery Act, in which there were supposed to be codes on prices and commodities to be sold. All of this was supposed to come about in principle to create equilibrium, but the Roosevelt administration gave the power to big business to work out the arrangements that everybody else, labor, consumers, was supposed to follow. So what we get is a kind of a new development, a new level of cooperation between government and the private economy and business and the world of business. And what comes into existence for many of the people whose works I use in my book is the culmination of a process in which government and business comes together to form a cooperative whole. So many people in the 1930s are looking at the New Deal and saying, well, the New Deal promised us recovery, but again, as many of the sources revealed, the recovery was a limited recovery from 34 to 37. It was enough to save Wall Street, but not enough to bring enough prosperity to Main Street. And so you get a second New Deal in 1935 as a result of the increasing pressure on labor, because 1934 is a very, very difficult year. The New Deal has stalled, and people are beginning to wonder now why the recovery hasn't come to the vast majority of people, but business is doing well. So what you get is you get a number of writers who are looking at the New Deal, and what they see is something that resembles what Mussolini brought about in Italy, which is a cooperative state, a partnership between capital and labor that is a phony partnership because capital has all of the power, and the state is essentially sanctioning that because that's what you have to do to save capitalism. And so the New Deal does that. But in the process of doing it, it means the advance of state capitalism, which then if state capitalism goes into a crisis, then the fascist processes that require the capitalist class to maintain power become even greater, and then you get something that could resemble what had happened in Italy, except that, again, these people who were writing in the 30s were saying that if fascism comes to America, or it's already coming, it's not going to look like Italy. It's not going to look like Germany. It's going to look utterly American. Its particular American form will mean that fascism, driven by the needs of big business and capitalist imperatives, could mean that fascism would evolve, would develop within the framework of the two-party system, which is what a woman named Carmen Hyder argued in her 1934 book, Do We Want Fascism?
And
there's a need to examine what the New Deal did, what it promised, and what it actually achieved, which is opposite of what we usually think it achieved. And therein lies the problem of liberalism and the extent to which liberalism represents the interests of monopoly finance capitalism, and then to the extent to which liberalism in the end serves fascist processes. And this is startling. You know, this is really startling.
Well, I mean, can you be like more like can you be more concrete in that the idea being or let me just restate to see if I understand it. The idea being that the New Deal promises a certain level of freedom for labor. That the government will provide freedom from the four freedoms, let's say, that FDR outlines, right? From freedom from want and other sort of freedom from the shackles of material needs in many respects. And yet what it ultimately delivers is really a freedom from those things only as mediated through finance capitalism, which will it's a freedom with an asterisk, as long as you function within our parameters in terms of debt and in terms of allowing us to have more control over the economy, then you're not going to quite get all those freedoms, but you'll get close enough that you think that it's within your reach on some level. I mean, is that essentially what we're looking at when you say?
Sam, see, there are world historical forces at work here that shape shape what happens in the U.S. So, for example, in the spring of in 1936. Roosevelt and his cabinet are looking at the 1937-1938 budget, right? Roosevelt decides to listen to Henry Morgenthau, his Treasury Secretary, who's a conservative Democrat and a friend of big business and an advocate of big business. And Roosevelt, because he had always been a fiscal conservative, decides that, well, the government has done enough. We're on the road to recovery, so they balance the budget, right? And as a result of balancing the budget and taking federal spending out of the budget, in which the government plays a compensatory role against whatever excesses and debits, whatever doesn't happen within the private economy. And so what we get is, as a result of the contradictions again between production and exchange and the problem of overproduction that begins to develop in the summer of 1937, as a result of that plus the federal government balancing the budget, we get a recession in 1937. It's a recession within the Depression. And within a couple of months, 2 million people are out of work. And winter in Chicago and Detroit and many, many other northern cities is just a nightmare for millions of people, you know, starving children out in the street again. So what does Roosevelt do in 38? He reverses himself. He admits that, yes, the liberals around me are right. That government has to be a permanent spender, balancing the budget, laissez-faire stuff is gone now. So we get the Keynesian turn, the Keynesian revolution in the U.S., which had been coming about gradually, but is complete when Roosevelt commits to that. So, you know, and this comes, I mean, the 37 recession comes after the 2 years after the Second New Deal, where workers and the American people win, and Social Security, the workers win the right to organize the union, and it was militant labor that achieved that. But then again, you see, everything is on the line in a recession within the Depression. And then the government comes back and basically says, yes, okay, we're going to restore spending, and then we're going to add more to it. And some of it we're going to add is for rearmament. So the recovery is in part based on the U.S. getting ready for a war against whom? Right. A war against fascism elsewhere. And so you see, I think this is how we students of history need to begin to understand fascism as not a one-time thing in Europe in the 20s and the 30s, and not as a ruthless dictatorship that as my sources say in the 30s, you have to look at the particular forms that fascism takes in different parts of the world. And what I've done in my book is to try to explain that more deeply on the basis of political economy and how the U.S. fulfills a specific role within the world economy. And ironically, then, if we define fascism as a function of monopoly finance capitalism, and we follow these two writers in 1938, who said that the germ of fascism is an American monopoly capitalism in the 1920s, but it doesn't become a force of ominous proportion until the 1930s. Then, as students of history, where do we look for fascism? Do we look at just Italy and then Germany? No, we have to look at the entire capitalist world, because fascism is a unique characteristic. Unlike all the other isms that we know of, it is fascism that is unique to the contemporary world.
It's fascinating. The coming of the American behemoth, the origins of fascism in the United States. Michael Joseph Roberto, thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link at majority.fm on the site.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Sam.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half, wherein we will get a little bit less involved. We'll just make fun of Mick Mulvaney, et cetera, et cetera.
I was waiting for the Professor Steve Schmidt material.
Oh, we do have who's this? Riptide?
Riptide has a new remix.
Oh, I like this. That's pretty good. All right, we will play this out, I guess, today. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we say thank you by giving you extra content every day. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Michael, today is Monday. Tomorrow will be Tuesday, as you're aware of.
Indeed.
And it is a return to the mean in terms of the Michael Brooks Show.
Yeah, people have been getting very unsettled by these schedule changes. Mark Blythe will be joining us, a legendary professor, the Beam Me Up Scotty economist. We'll be having a conversation on austerity, 2020, the economics of the election cycle, a whole bunch of other stuff. Will I be wearing a suit or a tracksuit? Find out. Also, Patreons of TMBS are going to be getting some a sneak peek at some exciting news tonight or tomorrow as well. Some West Coast related news. Patreon.com/TMBS.
And Matt?
Yeah, Literary Hangover. Coming up this Saturday is The Unparalleled Adventures of One Hans Fall by Edgar Allan Poe, which some people think is the first science fiction story.
Especially
people who want to slight Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
There you go. Hey, thanks again to LifeLock Identity Theft Protection for supporting today's show. Of course, no one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. With LifeLock, you get identity theft protection and additional features to help protect your devices against cyber threats. For as low as $9.99 a month, don't waste another second. Visit LifeLock.com/majority now to save 10% on your first year. That's LifeLock.com/majority for 10% off. LifeLock.com/majority. We'll see you in the fun half.
Why are you doing this?
I'm doing it because I think Howard's a great guy.
Because he's a great guy.
He loves his family. He loves his country.
He loves his family. Oh, and he's doing it for America, too. I forgot about
that. Howard Schultz thinks is that the polar opposites of the parties are so far apart, but the American people are close together. And maybe what we need is a choice for the American people to choose something different, a different path, a different kind of outcome.
Oh, my God. Pause it for a second. It is so beautiful. I hope he's making so much money.
Why? What his big idea is, politics is broken.
It's like a parfait of cynicism.
Politics is broken. And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
Yeah. Yeah. Say that one more time to me again. Yeah.
Risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
Well, that's exactly it. We need to risk the imagination of a new type of possibility.
You're Obama with job experience.
Oh,
you're Obama with
home business run.
You're the Obama home that run. Did build that.
Yeah, you're
now. Now I know why Starbucks is so huge.